The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Sports Talk 1240 is brought to you by DraftPot.com. DraftPot is changing fantasy sports. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with promo code SportsTalk1240 and receive a 100% deposit bonus. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome. Hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue here taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the third day of April, opening night. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We've got a tremendous show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in the legendary all-time fan favorite of the New York Mets, 1986 world champion Mookie Wilson will join us. In the second half, we'll talk to author Eric Sherman about his new book, Kings of Queens, Life Beyond Baseball with Those 86 Mets. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on WGBB. We have got some great stuff lined up for you in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page titled Sports Talk 1240. There you will find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest is, of course, best known for that October night, known as Game 6 in the New York fan lexicon in the 86 World Series. But to the diehard Met fan, he remains one of the most beloved and revered Mets to this day, a man of humility and honor, a man who knew hustle and teamwork, and who loved the game of baseball. Number one in your scorecards, number one in your hearts. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Mookie Wilson. Mookie, good evening.
Hey, good evening. How are you doing today?
Great to have you with us. It's a real pleasure. Now, Mook, growing up in South Carolina, who did you root for? Any favorite teams, favorite players?
No, when I was growing up here in South Carolina, the Braves were the only team that was nearby. You would see the Dodgers on the weekend on occasion. But I didn't get a chance to watch all that baseball because Saturdays I was busy playing baseball. So, I really didn't have any baseball idols. I mean, I was a player. I wasn't really a big fan. So, you know, that's pretty much how you describe it, I think.
Fine. Okay, wonderful. Well, you attended Spartanburg Methodist, Mookie. You were drafted by L.A. in the fourth round of the 76 draft, but you didn't sign for them. You wanted to hold on.
No, I didn't sign, really because it came as a total surprise to me. Baseball was not part of my plans. I'm not professionally anyway. I played the game because I loved it. Going to school was more important. My parents really wanted me to go to school, and they were against my doing anything else other than, you know, going to school. And they were avid baseball fans, but I think school meant more to them at that point. And since it was a surprise and I really didn't know where I stood, I decided not to sign.
I see, yeah. Well, you transferred to the University of South Carolina where you played for the great Bobby Richardson.
Well, actually, Bobby left that year, so my coach was actually Joel Raines.
Okay.
That was Joel Raines' first year at University of South Carolina. I did have to speak about Richardson the year before, but I wasn't on the team at that point. So I think a lot of people think that because Bobby's name is so prominent with the Carolina baseball program.
Uh-huh.
But Joel Raines was my coach, actually.
Okay, understood, Mook. Now, did you encounter, during those days in the South, a lot of bigotry, a lot of prejudice down there in South Carolina?
Yes. I mean, that was something that was really widespread a lot of. That being said, I will tell you that I played with some great teammates. I mean, they were just they were super to me. They were understanding to my position, which was really unique, being the only African American on the team.
Mm-hmm.
And the first to ever play at the school, actually. It was just great. But generally, I think that there was a lot of racism, bigotry, and it's just how people just really did not know how to get along at that point in time. But But I survived, and I think that's the most important thing. Yeah.
You did, definitely, Mookie. Now, you got called up to the majors in September of 80. You played for a guy by the name of Joe Torre. Now, could you see at that point, Mookie, when he just started out with the New York Mets as a skipper, that he would someday be in the Hall of Fame for managing?
I have to be honest with you, at that point, we were so bad, I don't think I survived.
Yeah.
You couldn't tell who was a good manager or coach with that team we had. We were just out there. You know, the one thing I will say that Joe was always a player's manager. And it took me a long time to figure what that term really meant. You know, Joe was really understanding with player, and I think it comes from he played and he understood what it took to play that game every day and how difficult it was. And, you know, he was very laid back. He never got overly emotional about anything. And Joe's biggest problem was he just didn't have the players, you know. But he was always the same guy. When I met him years later, when he went over to the Yankees and stuff, you know, he was the same guy. He just had better teams.
Yeah, understood, Mookie. Those were some rough days, yeah.
Yes.
Now, Torre even went as far as shifting the fan favorite at that time, the face of the franchise, Lee Mazzilli, to left field to let you play center field. Was there ever any tension between you and Mazzilli because of that?
Man, no, there was never any tension between Maz and I. As a matter of fact, Maz and I are best of friends right now. We are, his wife and my wife have always been close. We have, you know, I think initially when a young player comes up, you do have to learn how to coexist. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we both had to learn to do. I was playing a position that was not common for me in natural, which was right field, which is how I made the club earlier. And then later in the season when I was moved to center. But no, there was never any friction there. We were professionals, and I think that Maz, being a hometown favorite, he knew that he had a special place there. But, it's just one of those things that happens. And it was no fault of mine or his. It was just that they were going a different direction, and he understood. And I'm not saying that there wasn't some getting used to. There's always some getting used to. Mm-hmm. I'm a new kid on the block. He's a kid that has the reputation, who was he was an all-star, by the way.
Right.
Because I think people tend to forget that. But it was just a move that the organization was making to start bringing in fresher players, and I was probably the first of that wave.
Right. Now, talking to Mookie Wilson tonight on Sports Talk 1240, you hit two big home runs in 81, Mookie. The first one off of Joe Sambito, but both home runs were involved in the outcome of the ball game. And then September 20th, you took Bruce Sutter deep. I think Frank Tavares was on first base then. Do you remember those home runs?
Oh, how can I forget them?
Yeah.
To me, when people ask me what moments in my career stands out the most, you know, people, they naturally think that I'm going to see the World Series.
Right.
And of course, that was a big, big moment. I'm making no bones about that. But I think when you do something meaningful that decides a game at the major leagues, the first time you do something like that, that's the moment that lets you know that you belong, you know, that you've earned this. And I think that was what it was for me. I mean, come on, I hit a horn off the Hall of Famer, Bruce Sutter.
Right.
I mean, how many people can say that? I mean, he was unhittable in those days. And here comes a kid who, you know, no one really knew other than the name. I had no reputation or anything, and I do that. And it made me much more comfortable in the major leagues. I didn't back off for any situation. It was great for me.
Wonderful. Ubi Brooks came along with the Mets. That was certainly probably, Mookie, the first glimmer that there was a light at the end of the tunnel when you teamed up with Ubi Brooks to form maybe a little bit of a nucleus with the Mets ball club.
Yes, Ubi and I, we became very, very close. We played against each other in college. He went to Arizona State.
Oh, okay.
I was in South Carolina. We played against each other in the College World Series. In 77.
Okay.
Of course, they beat us 2-1. I never forget that. I'm still a little upset about that, but I'll get over it, you know. So, when we drafted Ubi, I was in my second year, and we played in Double A together. We played in Triple A together. We were roommates. We became the best of friends. When we came up to New York, we got called up to New York to play. You know, we thought we were going to be together, you know, forever. We really did, and we challenged each other. I think because we had that college reputation, that college you know, friendship, and we carried it over through the struggle of the minor leagues. It was great. When he was traded, I think that was the first blow I had in what professional baseball was all about. But we're still the best of friends, and you know, he's really, really a true gentleman, and he's had a great career, and I'm very happy for him.
Certainly. Now, another big thrill for you, Mookie, had to be breaking Tavares' team record of 58 stolen bases, and then you pass Maz, your old teammate, to become the team's all-time stolen base leader in 84. Of course, those records that you set came to be broken later by a guy by the name of Jose Reyes, but that had to be a big thrill for you.
Well, it's always a thrill when you do something that's a landmark. And, you know, we're talking to, you know, I mean, Maz was a pretty good player, and, you know, that's saying a lot to lead an organization in any statistical part of the game, for in the height of a short-lived MVP, you know, for records of being to be broken. And I felt really good about my accomplishment. That's not something that was in my mind. I wasn't conscious of it, but it's the kind of game that I played. And, you know, that's something that I can always, you know, my kids know about that, so I can always tell my grandkids. I may make the story a little bit better when I tell my grandkids, so I'm not going to tell everything. I'll just make it sound a little bit better. And it's definitely something I've been proud of, you know, just like everything else I've done in my career, regardless whether it's record-breaking or not.
Well, in 86, you get shifted. You're the guy to get shifted, Mookie. You go to left field because Lenny Dykstra takes over in center field. How did that strike you?
Well, you know, there that was a, you know, I make no bones about it, and I think everyone knows it wasn't really a popular decision made for me anyway, but it was a decision that management made, just like when they made the decision for me to take over from Maz. I mean, that's just the way the game goes. You don't have to like it, but you do have to respect it, and you still have a job to do. And that's the way Lenny and I took it, you know. Lenny was the new kid on the block. I was the old guy. And but you know, Lenny was one of the, he was a great outfielder, and I loved playing with Lenny because you knew what you were gonna get every day with Lenny. He was, I mean, they didn't call him Nails or nothing.
Right.
You know, he was a great ball player, and we had a great relationship. We still do to this day. I'm talking with him a couple months ago. We still have that great relationship because we respected what each other of us could do. But you know, to answer your question, no, I wasn't happy about the whole move.
Sure.
Because I wanted justification for it, and I never got that justified answer. But, you know, it all worked out. And, listen, we won the World Series. I mean, how can you complain about that?
Exactly. Let's move on to that famous topic now, Mookie. We'll talk a little bit about Game 6. Now, Schiraldi's on the hill. He retires Backman and Hernandez. Then he surrenders singles to the next three guys, bringing the score to 5-4. Do you feel a little worried when they pull Schiraldi and bring in Bob Stanley that maybe you'd rather hit against Schiraldi?
Well, of course I would rather hit against Schiraldi.
Right.
You know, no question. Mainly because I felt that I knew Schiraldi a little more for me with Schiraldi because he was in the organization. You know, Bob Stanley, we had faced early in the year some weird situation we ended up facing him, but I didn't know Bob Stanley as much as well as I knew Schiraldi. But, yeah, if I had my choice of people to face, it would have been Schiraldi. There's no question about that. But the answer was, the momentum was in our favor, and I didn't have time to think about who was going to be on the mound. That job now was to do the best I could.
Right. Now, he almost hit you with a wild pitch.
Yeah.
You did all you could to get out of the way of that. Did you ever think about what would have happened if he did hit you and how the game would have went on?
It would have hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, Mook. Yeah.
I think about it, you know, and if I had been smart, I would have been hit. You know, I would have been somebody else do the job. But, you know, we are taught how to get out of the way of baseball, and I was very difficult to hit. I mean, there's not many times I was hit in my career. I was always able to get out of the way of the ball. I always put myself in a position where I could always protect myself. And that ball, actually, it wasn't as close as I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be a lot closer than it actually was. So it looked a little more dramatic than it than it actually was. But, no, I think about it's a boy hitting me. I just go to first base. I'm glad it didn't, because if it had hit me, we wouldn't be talking today.
Right. Yeah. Who knows what would have happened, Mookie? You're
Who knows?
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
Now, what happens then is Kevin Mitchell comes in and ties the score at 5-5. Two pitches later, you hit that slow roller to Billy Buckner at first base. When you first hit that ball, Mookie, what's going through your mind?
You don't want to hear what went through my mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't want to hear what went through my mind. But anyway, it wasn't very nice, okay? It wasn't very flattering.
Yeah.
It wasn't reflective of my attitude, but it was at the moment. But, you know, I thought, actually, it's a pitch that was thrown that I really should have hit better. A pitch right in my location, middle and down. I mean, it was a perfect pitch for me, and I just, you know, just when it rolled over, if I had taken the same swing I did, and once I fouled off, it would have been a much better, you know, I would have hit the ball a lot harder. But then who knows what would have happened? But I was disappointed with the way I hit it. The good thing about it is I did what I set out to do, that was make contact, be that the score was tied already.
Right. Now, Billy Buckner catches that ball. Do you beat him to the bag?
That's the conversation that I think that most people want to talk about, and that's a question that I don't think there's no definitive way you can really answer that. But
Thought, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but Billy and I, we talked about it. And, you know, I think we both came to agree that, you know, even if he catches the ball, the odds are in my favor of beating him to the bag. And I feel very strongly that I would have beaten him to the bag.
Good, Mookie. Yeah, I think most Met fans want to hear that. And the next season they bring in McReynolds. Now, this displaces guys even more. Bringing in Kevin McReynolds to upset the apple cart a little bit. You request a trade. It goes ungranted, but you still have a great year.
Yeah. Well, you know, the trade request was out of frustration. It had nothing to do with New York. Had nothing to do with the team. It had to do with the decision management made to really reduce my at-bats. I mean, it was already reduced at the word, but it was going to be even less. Now we had an everyday left fielder, so that was going to put me to have even less at bats, and that was the purpose of the request for the trade. And I went from the GM to the manager, trying to get some resolve with the whole situation. They knew I weren't happy with it, but they also knew that I was going to go out there and give 100% regardless. Mm-hmm. It was one of those situations where, you know, I made known what I wanted. And I was just had to wait and see if it was going to happen. And they told me it wasn't going to happen. So, and it didn't. Not right away. So I just had to live with it.
Right. We're talking to Mookie Wilson tonight on Sports Talk 1240. The worst, Mookie, the worst situation that they brought about, and I think most Met fans would agree with me, is when they traded Dykstra and Roger McDowell to Philadelphia for Juan Samuel, expecting him to come in and fill the void in center field. And just one of the worst trades they ever made.
Well, to me, I mean, it wasn't a good trade in terms of the personnel. But even worse for me, I thought it was, and I might be a little blunt with this statement, but it's the way I feel. I thought it was the ultimate insult. You bring in on a guy who was second baseman to play center field, and your hand went sick on the bench.
Right.
You know? You know, so I saw the handwriting on the wall that this was my time here had ended, and that's when I really, really wanted to be moved for that reason. But to me, I thought it really disrupted the character of – of the club. Getting rid of, you know, Kevin Mitchell was a big blow. Mm-hmm. When Ray Knight didn't return, that was even a big blow.
Right.
But when we lost Lenny and McDowell, I mean, you could see that the team was not going to be the same team. You know, even though we still had good players, and Kevin McReynolds was a great ball player. Don't let anybody fool you. He was a very good ball player.
Sure.
Any day. But Kevin Mitchell had a personality. He was part of what we were all about. Nails was part of what we were all about. McDowell was part of what we were all about. And I think when they did, they disrupted that chemistry. And I know that words get thrown around very loosely, but if you understand what the chemistry is, then you can understand what I'm talking about, is that the respect of what each player can give to a team that's more than, you know, as football players say, X's and O's. You know, it was more than hits, runs, strikeouts, and wins. It was about the personality of the club.
So when you were sent to Toronto for Jeff Musselman, that probably wasn't as big a shock as you thought it was going to be. Correct, Mookie?
No, it wasn't as big a shock. I think I was just surprised because it happened when I least expected it. I mean, the trading deadline was about done, and it happened. And I said, well, I'm still going to be here. And then next thing I know, in the last day, you know, at the last hour, then they tell me that I've been traded. The thing that did surprise me was going to Toronto. But I should have known that they weren't going to trade me to a national club. I mean, I didn't think that was going to happen either. So, but Toronto was a great place for me. And a lot of times when teams don't trade people, they always use the term, we can't get equal value for you. Well, they got Jeff Musselman for me. So
yeah, right.
I don't know what that means. So
good deal.
I don't know how equal value comes in there. But, you know, I was happy and sad at the same time. I was happy that I would get a chance to play every day. But I was sad leaving New York.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't Jeff Musselman, Mookie. They also got the immortal Mike Brady, a pitcher. Who, of course, everyone will recognize Mike's name.
Yeah. It was great.
Man. Well, yeah. we'll take a look at The Kings of Queens, Eric Sherman's book. You had some real great things to say in that book, Mookie. I just wanted to ask you about what you said about Gary Carter, that he wasn't welcome when he first got to the Mets.
I think people, you know, tend to forget, that we were once, for lack of a better term, we were enemies. He played for the Expos.
Right.
You know. And you don't just, you know, develop friendships with the opposing team that easily. Gary Carter was an outstanding ball player. And like most outstanding ball players, you have to find something about them you don't like, even if it's not valid. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to have some motivation. And Gary was one of those guys who just got under everybody's skin.
Yeah.
He was just too nice. No one could be that nice and be that good. And, you know, that was Gary. And when he first came over, we still looked at him as an outsider. But once we got to know Gary and he really bent over backwards to really fit in, he was just as nice a guy. He was exactly what he portrayed to be. And I think we learned to appreciate him as a person more now than we did before. And we definitely always respected his ability to play. So this is what the whole story with Gary is. So, you know, to say that he wasn't really welcome at the very beginning, he really wasn't, because we felt he was invading on the New York Mets, and he wasn't part of our little group, and he turned out to be more than a part. He turned out to be, you know, a big, big part of what we really were.
Yeah, he sure was, Mookie. You're exactly right. You also had some interesting things to say about Wally Backman and about the chances of Wally coming up to manage the Mets someday.
Yeah, you know, I think that, and, you know, my opinion might be a little biased. I would throw that disclaimer out there a little bit, because Wally and I have been good friends. We've always been good friends. We've always been good teammates. And we also, you know, we played together in AAA, and we came up together. We were also in that movement, that youth movement.
Right.
And Wally has proven to be a very good baseball guy. He's a baseball man. There's no ifs, ands, and buts about it. He's more, because all good players don't make good managers or coaches. Now, I will say that. You know, but Wally is the exception to that rule, if you want to make it a rule. Because people, I think, one thing that those teams, those players didn't get, and that was credit for their baseball wit. You know, they were very, very smart players, and Wally was definitely one of those smart players. And I've watched him over the years in the minor leagues as a manager. Players love him. Players respect him. And, you know, he's a little bit old school, but I'm telling you what, man, that's a good way to be. And I just don't think that he's a little bit of a renegade, maybe. I don't think that he's so ready for that, you know, that yet. And because he shoots from the hip. You know, he's not sugarcoating anything. He's a straight-up guy. And sometimes that's not always good. You know, sometimes you have to be a little bit more of a politician. And while it's not, he's not a politician.
They wouldn't give him to me to be on the show, Mookie, because they didn't know what he was going to say.
Well, I
that'll give you an idea right there, you know.
Yeah, you know, but you know, he is a good baseball man, and he's a super guy, and I think he deserves an opportunity to mention Mitch.
Going back to the Buckner play. You say that it really didn't define you guys, but it really does, doesn't it?
You know, I say, and Bills will say the same thing.
Not to your fault, fault, Mookie, but it's just so overriding.
Yeah, it really didn't define us, but it does. Well, that's what we say, but it kind of does, because you know, through it all, our personalities really do come out. And what we kind of contribute to the game. So, you know, yes, I would like to be remembered. I would like people to come to me and say, hey, I remember that home run you hit off Bruce Sutter. Now, I remember that stolen base. I remember when you scored from first base and second base on outs. And stuff. I would love to do that, but understand, 86 was a moment in history. It was a moment in baseball history. It was a moment in my life and Bill Buckner's life that everyone lived, and we just look. We can't deny people that luxury of that joy to discuss the whole thing. Which we had some problems at first, but now it's not. We welcome it and we discuss it very candidly. And Bill has become as open with the whole situation as I've always been, and we are very comfortable. But you know, like I say, that play, it is who we are. We just have to admit that.
It's a shame with Bill Buckner, too, because what a stellar career he had with 2,700 hits. He really had a fine major league career, and most times it just comes down to game six with Bill, especially with Boston fans.
Well, I think that we all get caught up in the moment sometimes, that we have a moment that we want to define players by. And unfortunately, I don't know who does the voting for the Hall of Fame. I have spoken to some of the writers, and they don't have any criteria that they can put on paper and say, this is what we're looking for.
Right.
They don't have that.
No.
And I think that's wrong, because if you look at Bill Buckner's career and what he has contributed to the game, not only him, you have other guys like Keith Hernandez. Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm doing a little politics here now for guys that I like. So
that's okay.
I think you can name about 10 guys on top of your head that you think were just outstanding ball players and contribute unbelievable to. All right, so they didn't have 3,000 hits. So they didn't have 500 home runs. So they didn't have 150 stolen bases a year. So it's what they contribute to the game. And I think that's where a mistake is being made. I think Buckner's numbers stand for themselves. I think that he should be in the Hall of Fame. But if they want to say, well, he don't have enough hits, okay. I mean, if that's one criteria, then we have to go back and look at a lot of people who didn't have those numbers.
Right. Good point, Mookie. Well, Mookie, I tell you, it's been a great speaking with you tonight, talking about baseball and about the Mets. I thank you for sharing part of your Sunday night with us.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure to talk a little baseball.
You take care, Mookie. Mookie Wilson, ladies and gentlemen. Up next, we'll talk to author Eric Sherman about his new book, Kings of Queens, Life After Baseball with the 86 Mets. Stay with us, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPot has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. What are you waiting for? Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your Gust Buster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines. Also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this opening night. The Mets tonight with Harvey on the Hill in Kansas City. I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. Well, my next guest prior to his current project was co-author of New York Mets great Mookie Wilson's autobiography, Mookie, Life, Baseball, and the 86 Mets. That book made the New York Times bestseller list for sports hardcovers in May of 2014. Prior to working with Mookie, Eric teamed up with Pittsburgh Pirates pitcher Steve Blass on Steve Blass, A Pirate for Life. That book tells the story of the former Pittsburgh's pitcher whose inexplicable control problems at the peak of his all-star major league career made Steve Blass disease a part of the American lexicon. Now, his first book, Eric wrote the critically acclaimed Glenn Burke autobiography, Out at Home. The Glenn Burke story in 1995, which chronicled the life of the first Major League Baseball player to reveal his homosexuality. But his latest book is entitled Kings of Queens, Life After Baseball with the 86 Mets. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Eric Sherman. Eric, good evening.
Good evening, Bill. How are you?
Wonderful. It's great to have you with us tonight. We just had a great conversation with Mookie Wilson.
Oh, great, great. Well, No shocker there. Mookie has some terrific stories and tells those stories only like he can.
Very, very candid. Very great interview. Great guy. Now, growing up, Eric, who were your favorite teams? Any favorite players that you idolized?
Yeah, you know, I started watching baseball in 1973, and your Mets fans know what year that was. That was the year that they went to the World Series and lost in seven games to the A's. My father was a Yankee fan.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he was. But we only went to Mets games because at the time, even though I grew up in New Jersey, we were spending time with my grandmother out in Bayside, Queens. So we would go to quite a few Mets games, and my favorite player, well, I had two really, Rusty Staub mm-hmm. and Willie Mays were my two favorite players at the time.
Two great ones. Two greats. Now, Eric, was it the 40th anniversary of this 86 ball club that made you write this book, or do you feel it was just time to do it?
You mean the 30th anniversary?
I'm getting ahead of myself here.
No, that's all right. That was a nice, convenient thing that occurred, that this was falling on the 30th anniversary. The timing's great, but what really created in my mind the need to come out with a book like this was really born from a conversation I had with Mookie's wife, Rosa. Mookie and I were on the book signing tour, and we were in our eighth bookstore in 6 days. He had signed like over 2,500 books, and so it was our last one. It was our last book signing. And Rosa asked me what my next book project was going to be. And I said to her, well, I'm kind of thinking about Roberto Clemente. I'm trying to find an angle, though. You know, but I had so many contacts, you know, from doing the book with Steve Blass. But I couldn't really think of an angle, so I wasn't sure. And she said, well, you know, why don't you – I'd love to know what's up with guys like Sid Fernandez and you know, guys from the 86 team. And so I thought about it, and I'm like, you know, Roger Kahn wrote a pretty good book about the Brooklyn Dodgers many, many years after covering them in Brooklyn, you know, actually going out and visiting the players all over the country. And I thought, you know, if I did something like that with the key and more riveting guys from that team – that would make a pretty good book and would tie in nicely with the 30th anniversary.
And it certainly did, Eric. Now, give the folks a little overview of the process that you went through in interviewing all these former Mets.
Planes, trains, and automobiles.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I traveled over 30,000 miles, crisscrossing the country, visiting these guys over an 8-month period, visiting them in their homes, their dugouts, their favorite bar, wherever, but visiting them in their current environs, and I felt that would add a lot to the book. How did I contact them? You know, I got to know a few of the players through Mookie, through the book that we did together. Ed Hearn was a help in my contacting some of the others. The Baseball Alumni Association was a big help, and other writers who had worked with the players were a help also. So any way I could get in touch with these guys, I followed every lead. And I think what really helped, Bill, was the fact that I had done the Mookie book, because no player from that team, that 86 team, is more highly regarded than Mookie. And I think a lot of them figured that if I did a book with Mookie and he entrusted me to help him with his memoir, that I was good enough for them to talk to.
Great point, Eric. Yeah, very good point. We're talking to Eric Sherman tonight on Sports Talk 1240. We'll go through a couple of the stories of the guys, starting with the guy who wrote the foreword, Davey Johnson. Now, he had a couple of interesting things to say, Eric, talking about Lenny Dykstra. He calls him a competitor and a gambler. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, he was, or it is. I mean, Mookie once quipped to me that he would bet on everything. Like, if there were two flies on the wall, he would bet you which one would fly first. You know, he was just so competitive in everything he did. And you know, what Davey has brought up time and time again is when they would go golfing together, and you know, Lenny, you know, was not a particularly great golfer, and he would go up against scratch golfers like Davey, and you know, he wouldn't ask for any strokes. I mean, he wanted to beat people straight up, and he just loved the action. And Lenny lives his life; he's always doubling down, and following his baseball career. Of course, he was on quite a roll. I mean, he was doubling down on his car washes, on his magazine, a whole lot of things, with his options trading. And he was doing well for a while until the bottom dropped out. And, you know, someone that knows him said that at one point he was probably worth close to $100 million. And in an 18-month period, he blew it. You know, I mean, he just went through it, and for a variety of reasons. Some of it was his real estate holdings, including his primary home, the Wayne Gretzky house that he bought.
I recall.
Yeah. And, you know, Lenny ended up in jail and had a rough time in prison. He was beaten by some prison guards, according to him, and you know, somebody knocked all those teeth out. You know, that was something that he revealed to me during our meeting. And it's just very sad. Now he's trying to put his life together now, and he's working hard to do that. But Lenny has seen the highest peaks and the lowest lows.
He certainly has. Nails, definitely. Now, an interesting thing Davey had to say also, Eric, was about the second baseman of the future at one point. The Bamberger had high regard for him, Brian Giles versus Wally Backman.
Yeah, the organization was very high on Giles, and even Davey would tell you that as a talent, Giles had it all over Backman. But there was something about Backman, his competitive spirit, his fire, and he just outworked everybody and out-prepared everybody. And that was the kind of guy that Davey wanted on his team. And he just said to Wally, look, you know, you just go out there and, you know, just take, you know, a ton of ground balls and get your hitting in, and you're my guy. And, you know, Davey believed in Wally perhaps more than he believed in anybody. The two of them have a tremendous admiration for each other, even today. And I know it just breaks Davey's heart that Wally hasn't had a chance to manage at the major league level.
Now, you bring up that point. We might as well go to what Mookie Wilson said, Eric, and that about Wally Backman not managing the Mets. Talk a little bit about that statement.
Well, in the book, yeah, Mookie wonders whether Wally will ever get a shot.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Wally's very open. You know, he doesn't hide a whole lot. You know, a lot of managers today, they act like politicians. That's not Wally. Wally's going to say what's on his mind. And as Mookie mentioned in his chapter, you know, that's worked against Wally. And, you know, the thing you have to realize about the Mets, Bill, is that Sandy Alderson runs that team. And, you know, Collins, he's the manager for sure, and he makes some of the decisions, but Sandy's very much involved, not just with front office and personnel decisions, but also what goes on the field. And that type of situation, I think what Mookie's trying to say is that Wally would have a very tough time working for someone like Sandy, and
yeah.
Sandy would probably have a hard time overseeing a manager like Wally. They're just two type A personalities. And, you know, the game has just changed so much where, you know, like you're seeing managers today where Wally, you know, has forgotten more about baseball and about managing than these guys even know. And they're getting jobs because the general managers want to control everything.
Yeah, great point, Eric. Yeah, you're exactly right. And I agree with what you said and what Mookie said about Wally Backman managing the Mets. Too much difference between Sandy and Wally to work together. I agree. Now, we'll move on to Kevin Mitchell. Now, I had Kevin on the show about 2 years ago, Eric, and we were talking about that barehanded catch he made.
Yeah.
And he made the mistake of saying to me, are you talking about the cat or the catch? So I said, well, being that you brought it up, Kevin, let's talk about the cat. Now, let people know about the cat, Eric, what we're talking about.
Sure. So in Dwight Gooden's book, I think it was Heat, right?
Yeah, I think that was it.
Yeah. So Doc's written at least a couple of books now. Well, in Heat, there was a statement in there how Kevin Mitchell got upset with his girlfriend and decapitated the cat with a knife. And, you know, to get back at her, you know, I guess they were having an argument. And that was in Dwight's book, Heat. And, you know, I talked to Dwight about it, and Dwight said, you know, the people that wanted me to write this book, Doc was going through a period where he just wanted to be agreeable with everyone. You know, he didn't want to turn anybody down and did things for other people. And so the co-author said, you know, we should put this in there. And Doc says, yeah, you know, it's fine. And, you know, something like that's really serious. And it got back to Mitchell. And, you know, Mitchell thought about suing Doc over that.
Yeah.
But then, you know, they met and they worked it out. And then fast forward to just last year, and Daryl Strawberry was giving an interview, and the interviewer brought up about the cat. And and Daryl said, yeah, you know, well, Mitchell, he grew up in a gang environment and, you know, pretty rough, and it's pretty crazy, but he did do that. And
wow.
And Mitchell, you know, he calls Strawberry and he's like, you know, why'd you say that? You know, you were you there? Did you see it? You know, why would I do that when there's 1,000 J-Lo's in New York City? You know, I wasn't tied down to just one woman. And, you know, I love animals. And Strawberry said, well, you know, I wasn't prepared for the question. And, you know, it just kind of caught me off guard. And so anyway, I know Mitchell, you know, has gotten apologies from Gooden and Strawberry. But Mitchell's out there, you know, with people thinking that he really did it. And he'd really like Straw to go on national TV sometime and just set the record straight.
Refute the cat story. Yeah, I agree, Eric. Great point. We're speaking to Eric Sherman, author of Kings of Queens, Life After Baseball with the 86 Mets. One other thing about Kevin Mitchell, Eric. He comes out and says in the book that he wasn't the bad one. Talking about, again, him, Doc, and Strawberry. He wasn't the one, the bad apple in that bunch.
Yeah, you know, he claims the only year he ever had a drink in his life was 86. And it was just because it was just such a fraternity, such a party atmosphere. And you know, I mean, I've been with Mitchell quite a bit over the last couple of years. And he doesn't drink. And, you know, he doesn't do drugs. And he didn't then either, you know. But the team, from Frank Cashin on down, they were worried that he would have a negative influence on some of their young players, like Strawberry, like Gooden, like Dykstra. And it was the furthest thing from the truth, you know, just because he grew up in a gang environment, they just assumed that Mitchell was a thug and would lead some of these young Met stars astray. And but Mitchell was like, you know, these guys were already up in the major leagues when I came up.
Right.
You know, I was the guy that was new, you know, the new kid on the block. And how was I going to influence these guys? And it was a huge loss when they lost Mitchell. One of the things that surprised me when interviewing these guys was the value that they placed on the two guys that they lost after 86. Kevin Mitchell and Ray Knight.
Exactly.
They would say that these guys brought an intimidation factor to the team that was sorely missing after 86. And it completely, the Mets lost a lot of that intimidation factor, and it completely changed the dynamic of the team. They were still very talented. And, you know, Bill, if you look at it, you know, they replaced Ray Knight with Howard Johnson full-time, who was a better talent. And they got Kevin McReynolds in exchange for Mitchell. And at the time, you could argue that McReynolds was the more established player. But, you know, McReynolds had no swagger at all and you know, didn't love playing in New York and couldn't wait to get out of the stadium after the game was over. And
you're right, yeah.
So you had you really lost that edge, that edginess that the Mets had, that swagger after 86, and so that really shows the value of a Mitchell. And you know, the guy went on in 89 to win the MVP award and help the Giants to the World Series.
He sure did. Now, an interesting point that Bobby Ojeda brings out in the book, Eric, that I thought was great, was that the 86 Mets, they didn't want to beat you. They didn't want to just beat you. They wanted to burn down your village.
Yeah. Yeah. He and Dykstra have no filter at all. And, you know, the Dykstra interview was the strangest interview I've ever had. But Ojeda is just so entertaining. And I really miss him on the pre- and post-game.
Definitely,
That he
yeah.
used to do for SNY. He's just so unfiltered, and So, yeah, he said that 86 team, we wanted to burn down your village. I mean, not just beat you, but, you know, really beat you bad. And that was the swagger that everyone talks about. And they never had it since.
No. But what a great quote. Now, getting back to Lenny, one interesting thing that he brought out was his opinion of current Mets manager Terry Collins.
Yeah, I can't really repeat on live radio what he said. But in Lenny's special way, he was describing what he thought of Collins as a manager based on how he managed the Houston Astros players, mm-hmm. like Bagwell and Biggio.
Did he actually say, Eric, that Biggio and Bagwell did not like Terry Collins?
He did say that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and Dykstra said, you know, if you can't like Biggio and Bagwell, there's something wrong with you. Like, if you can't get along and you can't manage those guys, because those two are, like, the greatest dudes, as Lenny would say, in the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Collins had never won before the last year. And, you know, and he hadn't managed a major league team in a very long time. And it all goes back to Alderson, I think, wanting to control the team. And by bringing Collins back and giving him another shot, after all those years of not being in the major leagues, you know, I think it speaks volumes. Now, you can't really argue with Alderson's success with the way things unfolded last year, but he does have a firm grip on the entire organization.
Yeah, he does. He really had no choice but to bring Terry back, is what I feel, and that's his boy.
Yes.
And that's the bottom line.
It's a good way to describe it.
Yeah. Now, talking about one guy that not too many people may remember was the reliever Doug Sisk. He had a bad time in New York, Eric.
Yeah, you know, they had a 24-man roster back in 86, not 25. And I think every member of that 86 team is just still revered. You know, even Ed Hearn, who's like the 23rd or 24th man on that team, by his own admission, you know, he would say that. You know, each one of those guys is just beloved in this city. And there's just one that isn't, and that's Doug Sisk. And,
yeah.
And you know, I hope that the profile that I did with him in this book will let fans know a little bit about what happened with Doug Sisk. You know, this was a guy that his first couple of years with the Mets, you know, his first 2 years in the big leagues were phenomenal.
He was lights out, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was arguably the best pitcher that they had amongst the starters or relievers. His ERA was like two or under his first 2 years with the club. And what happened, well, a couple of things happened. One, he was overused, and he had something like 20 bone chips in his arm. And you know, these were the days before those things were diagnosed so quickly. Now, if you have a nosebleed, you have three trainers working on you.
Yeah.
But back then, it was very different. And so he was pitching hurt for a while, and that's when he was starting to get hit. And he was never really a control pitcher anyway because his ball moves so much. But fans don't understand that he was pitching hurt, and he got hit real hard in probably the highest profile game the Mets had played in years, in that September game against the Cubs on national TV on that Saturday afternoon. And the Mets were, I think, six games out, and it was like September 8th, so they still had like 3 weeks to go, and it was a must-win at Shea Stadium, and it was the day after Dwight Gooden had one-hit the Cubs. And the place was just rocking, and Sisk had just an awful outing. And he was just booed mercilessly off the field. And fans never let him forgive that. And then in 85, you know, he was still pitching hurt, and right up until the time he got surgery, and just another awful year. And, you know, 85, the Mets had such high expectations you know, they had gotten Carter, and so the fans were just brutal on him. And you know, the one story in the book that Sis tells is, you know, Davey Johnson went out for a mound visit to see Sisk, and Sisk said, you know, you better keep some distance between the two of us so they won't get us both with one shot. So
unbelievable, yeah.
So he had a good personality about it, but it hurts, you know. It's very hard, but Sisk has coached kids on how to accept all kinds of adversity in baseball, you know, taking the good with the bad. And so he's made the most of it.
Yeah, another great story told by Eric in Kings of Queens, Life Beyond Baseball with the 86 Mets, the story of former reliever Doug Sisk. Now, one person I found fascinating that you spoke to was Sandy Carter, the widow of Gary.
Yeah, that was a great interview, and she is such a lady. Just an unbelievable baseball marriage that she had with Gary. And, you know, there's so many great stories, that she told me, but I'll tell you one of them. You know, a lot of people are finding out, especially after Mookie's book and now with this one, Gary Carter, when he first came to the Mets, was not a popular guy in the clubhouse.
We spoke about that. Yeah, Mookie and I did touch on that.
Yeah, and, you know, now that, you know, Gary has passed, and it's ironic because he's the only player from that team that's no longer with us, and Gary lived the cleanest life of all of them by far. You know,
yeah.
Gary was a family man, a man of faith, you know, didn't party, you know, took care of himself, you know, enjoyed the cameras and all that. But a lot of it was done so he could make money, you know, for his family. And, you know, the one day put his kids through college. And but the players, you know, they were very they were a wild bunch. And they went out and they partied. They were like rock stars,
yeah,
for the most part. So they were very different. And so Carter could not have been more unlike most of them if he tried. And so to describe that relationship, especially the first couple of years, Sandy was talking with Gary while Gary was on the road, and Gary said, "Yeah, I went out to the movies tonight with myself and my two best friends." So Sandy goes, "Oh, really? Who'd you go out with?" And Gary goes, "Me, myself, and I."
Yeah, right.
And so, but if you want to wrap a ribbon around this book, it's the evolution of the relationship and the admiration the 86 Mets had for Gary Carter, because from the point he joined the team in the 85 season to the time that he died, that team completely changed how they feel about Gary. I mean, so many of them just have come to admire him so much and wish that they had lived their lives more like Carter did.
Great point, Eric. Well, I tell you, Eric, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. Thanks for taking the time out to be with us. The book is titled King of Queens, Life Beyond Baseball with the 86 Mets. Thanks a lot, Eric.
Thanks so much, Bill.
Take care. Eric Sherman, folks. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Mookie Wilson and Eric Sherman, my engineer, Brian Graves, and most of all, you for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you Sunday, April 17th. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.